Welcome to the Agile Career Podcast, where we will take you on the journey from employed for life to employable for life. We'll give you the tips, insights, and strategies to help you build the transferable skills that you'll need. So let's get started. Please welcome your host, Günther Richter.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the next episode of the Agile Career Podcast. I've got a really exciting guest for you today. This guest has made a significant change in his career. Of course, this is what this podcast is all about those big career changes. So on today's show, I've got Tom Rees, who is a doctor with the NHS. And just for the sake of our listeners outside of the UK, the NHS is our National Health Service, which provides the population with all of its health servicing requirements. So I'm not going to steal away too much from Tom's introduction. What I'll do is hand over to Tom. And Tom, welcome to the show. I'm really glad to have you on here today.
Oh, thank you.
Do you want to take a few moments and introduce yourself and talk a little bit about your role at the moment?
My name is Tom Rees. I am a doctor currently working at Winchester Hospital. I am a GP trainee, so training to be a GP. I'm in my first year of that, having completed 2 years of what we call foundation placement, so the first 2 years of junior doctors out of university. Before that, I did 6 years of university of study, and before that, I was a professional rugby player.
And therein is the significant shift. So I think, many people make changes in their careers. They change roles within organizations. But I think, the example that you've just given there is a truly significant one, and really keen to learn a little bit more about it. So I guess, having described two vastly different careers, professional rugby and medicine, thinking back to when you were during those formative years, I guess, when you were back at school, what was your thinking in terms of careers? Did you have any ideas of what you wanted to do?
So the only thing that I was ever absolutely certain of was that I was never going to be a doctor. So both my parents are doctors. My dad they're both retired now. Dad was a psychiatrist. Mum, I think, started training anaesthetics, but became full-time mum for a while with myself and my two younger brothers, and then went back to work and worked part-time. And it wasn't anything that I saw in their lives that put me off or anything. I'm going to go and do my own thing. I didn't know what that was. I think at one point I'd seen a TV show called Murder One. And I suddenly decided, right, I want to be a lawyer, because it was this big courtroom drama and that looked quite interesting. I did some work experience, which put me off that fairly quickly. So I never really knew. And then I got very fortunate in that rugby sort of presented itself as an opportunity. It was my hobby, and I was playing as much as I could, and I was quite good at it, and was progressing through sort of representative levels, and providing me opportunities to sort of go to change the path I thought I was on. I was at a comprehensive school in Basingstoke and was going to go to a local sixth form college. I played for the England under 16 team and had offers from sort of more established rugby playing schools to go and do my sixth form there. And it was, well, I'll get a better education there than I would, or at least, in most of them, I thought I'd get a better education than I would do staying in Basingstoke, and I'd get a chance to play more rugby. So I thought, well, why not? And then again, what a common theme in all of the things I've done has been sort of luck, essentially. At the time, I went to the Royal Grammar School in High Wycombe, and the year I started there, then they were London Wasps were in the process of moving out to Wycombe. They were setting up links with the local schools. I got picked up into their academy, and I can remember driving my form tutor in the grammar school nuts, because everybody else was planning for university and that. And I didn't have a clue, and I had this option of a professional contract. I thought, oh, okay, well, I'll go and give that a go and see what happens. And that turned into a 9-year professional career.
And I like the way you sort of refer to a common theme as being luck. And, you know, I think it was another sports professional, Gary Player, who said, the more I practice, the luckier I get. So I think it's just, you know, obviously worth pointing out to listeners that it's not just like winning the lottery. There's a bit of graft that goes into it. And
I really like that Gary Player quote. I used that in a as part of the rugby, we had some media training, and in one of these mock, you know, as sort of, you know, 19 year olds, we were kind of sat down and told how to be, you know, careful not to say anything too stupid. In one of the practices, I used it and sort of said, the more I sort of practice the luck I become. And the interviewer turned around and said, you need to be careful with that quote because, and I don't know, I've not, to my shame, looked it up to see if it's true. But he said, rather than player acknowledging the luck that plays a part, he was saying that apparently he was chipping in from off the green far more regularly than anybody else. And, you know, reporters would say, oh, you know, a bit of luck there. And he'd say, well, you know, the more I practice doing that, the luckier you think I become. And I love the quote because it's got that double meaning of this isn't just luck, this is me preparing. But then equally, you know, you're right, it ties in, but luck plays such a huge part in every success story. And it'd be silly to pretend otherwise.
Yeah, and I'm going to come back to that a little bit later in the interview, but just going back to, you know, your choice of career and talking about both your parents being in the medical profession, I think this is a challenge that many people find is that their parents say to them, I think you should do this thing, or I want you to go to university and study this thing. And, you know, I suppose the subject matter aside, one of the things that we're starting to recognize is that there's really no such thing as a job for life, you know, as it may have been for our parents, you know, working, you know, for many years at a bank or working for many years as a healthcare professional. And part of the things that we're looking to draw out in this podcast is helping people become employable for life. So developing those transferable skills. And so, you know, I'm quite glad you touched on that because often I think it's a difficult conversation with parents and guidance counselors, or, you know, whoever may have a say in terms of guiding you in your career. You also mentioned some work experience. You said you had ambitions to perhaps become a lawyer. I think that was quite a significant bit you spoke about there in terms of the work experience, because, you know, before jumping in wholeheartedly and saying, I'm going to sign up to law school, you thought you'd give it a go.
Yeah, I think it was part of, again, you know, secondary school, and, you know, getting to the age, you know, picking GCSEs and, you know, what is it you want to be when you grow up, being the kind of question you're asked. And I didn't really know. I'd seen some glamorous make-believe TV show and thought, oh yeah, that looks like fun. And I think I spent, it was 2 weeks, and I spent 1 week at, I think it was, I'm not even sure what the first week was, but it wasn't really legal work. It was in an office somewhere. And then the second was it was property law. And so neither sort of, you know, the courtroom thing that I thought that I was going to enjoy, but they did arrange one day for me to go down to the local Basingstoke court. And I sort of sat in there and kind of just to watch the proceedings. And I think it was something like, it was about the sixth or seventh case got called before there was any evidence or anybody had turned up. I think the first thing, well, we're, first case we're supposed to hear is this, but so-and-so isn't here, or we're supposed to do this, but this hasn't turned up. And I was just sort of sat there as a sort of 14, 15-year-old just thinking, this seems like an absolute farce. And, you know, it's just scratching the surface. It wasn't enough of an experience to really give me any meaningful information on what that sort of life or career would be like. But just as a first impression of it, I was just like, oh, well, this isn't for me.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the work experience thing is, you know, however deep you go into it is valuable. It's you know, both from the skills you pick up and I guess there's an element of trial before you buy. But really, I think, you know, in terms of some of the skills you learn. You spoke about, obviously, you started playing rugby at school. You joined Basingstoke Rugby Club, the local rugby club. You talked about being selected for England under-16s. You were awarded a Player of the Year, I think, for the under-16s. How significant was this for you? I mean, you know, potentially comparing, you know, to what other people were thinking about, as you say, thinking about going to university and all of those things. How significant was that for you?
I think certainly prior to that under 16 year, I'd never really considered that rugby was an option as a career. It was, you know, I was enjoying playing it and I was just kind of progressing through all the levels. You know, we at Basingstoke, we had a very sort of good team. So we'd win sort of county championships and that led to selection for the county team. And then that led to selection for the divisional team. And it kind of, it just snowballed and I was hanging out with my mates. They were going to the trials and I was going with them. So there wasn't much thought into it at that point. Once I started getting the offers of sort of places at more traditional rugby playing schools, it was kind of like, oh, okay. And they would each talk about the connections they had with whatever the local rugby clubs were and how there was possibilities to get involved. So it'd be silly to say that I wasn't considering it at that stage, but there was the other element that they were all slightly, with the way rugby was structured, they were all slightly more established, older sort of academic institutions. And I think that was one of the things that attracted me to the grammar school in High Wycombe. It was one of the few that actually sort of did say, you know, we want you to come here, but only if you achieve a certain level of grades. The others, some of the others were just more an open, if you can catch a rugby ball, you can come. So I know, and I know that appealed to my parents. So there was still a thought of, okay, I need to get an education because the prospect of a professional sports career is still sort of, you know, slightly ethereal, you know, it wasn't far from guaranteed. But then fairly quickly during my lower sixth year with WASC setting up links with the academy, it was sort of said, look, you know, there's a, you know, providing you don't, you know, have some sort of career ending injury at that point, you know, there's a contract there for you if you want it. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I think this is something that I found massively when I went then to university at sort of age 27, 28, you know, surrounded by 10 people who were sort of 10 years younger than me. They were saying, oh, what, you know, or not to say, but some people were like, wow, it's really brave to go back and do something like that when you're older. And I was thinking, well, no, it's not at all. I've had 10 more years to think about this and try out other, and see other things and gain more work, you know, not necessarily work experience, but gain more experience just in life generally. Whereas you're 18, haven't got a clue necessarily who you really are yet. You know, they're still sort of growing and developing. And then sadly, there are some people, particularly, you know, in medical school who after a few years probably don't want to be there and it's not going to be the right thing for them. But there's the whole kind of sunk cost fallacy that, well, you know, I start, so I've, you know, I've got to see it out. And I didn't have that issue, thankfully.
Yeah, I really like the way you sort of you know, flip that round there and saying, you know, if anything, I've had 10 years more to think about it. So it's a really good way of thinking like that. I guess you know there's an element of timing as well, because I guess if you look back prior to 1995, when rugby started becoming professional, you probably wouldn't have had this choice of rugby as a career. So, you know, there's something in the timing as well. And I guess going back to that moment when you realized this rugby really could be a career, you know, when was that something gradual, you know, as your successes snowballed as you've described them, or was there a pivotal moment when you said, hang on a second, this is something I can do?
Primarily it was just the slow evolution and the snowballing of it. I think it was at the tail end of my lower sixth, or first at the beginning of my upper sixth year, was when the academy guys at WASP turned around and said, there is a contract for you, you know, when you finish school, if you want it. And once it was actually, you know, there was the offer was there, then it was kind of like, okay, am I going, is is this where I'm going? And everything is going in that direction. I think it came at a fortunate time because that's when everybody else was applying for university. And without, I think I applied to keep the form tutor happy. I think it was something like sports science or, I'm not even really sure, but it's not anything that I was sort of particularly driven towards. It was just, if I have to, I might as well put that. But I think the beginning of the upper sixth year, the offer for a contract was there. The academy guys came to meet with me and my parents, kind of discuss what sort of life would look like. And actually that was really interesting because I think, for so many people, the idea of professional sport, you think, oh, brilliant, I'm being paid for my hobby and everything's great. And yes, that is true. But there was a guy called Rob Smith who ran the academy at Wasps who insisted on sort of meeting my parents, who had always always been very supportive of whatever I wanted to do. I mentioned that I didn't want to be a doctor because I think they were quite relieved at that. They've never made me do anything, but kind of just encouraged me to do everything, if that makes sense. Rob insisted on coming and meeting with them, despite them saying it was up to me. And he sort of sat down and basically said, look, it's going to be pretty rubbish. Your mates are going to be at university and going and getting drunk and doing all the sort of things that teenagers do. You're going to be getting up at 5, 6 a.m. to come into train at, starting at 7. You're going to have loads and loads of downtime in between training sessions, but not really an awful lot you can do with it because you can't necessarily go anywhere. He kind of painted a fairly stark picture of what the reality was like. So I was going in with, probably silly to say eyes open, but I'd certainly been forewarned. But ultimately it was like, well, I've got a chance to get paid for playing rugby, and it puts off having to make any other decisions. So I think it was those meetings were the moment, like, right, I'm committing to this, but it had just kind of snowballed up till then.
Okay, and I guess it's that building on success, and I think snowballing's a really great way to describe it. So there was the London Wasps, the academy contract, and then I think the full contract, there was England under 18s and under 19s. So this was all really coming together quite nicely at this point in time.
I think I was very fortunate in Basingstoke. We had a very good team and we used to travel to place at a stronger opposition rather than just stay within the local area. But then once you're on and in that sort of rugby school circuit, you're playing sort of high level games every week and there's normally someone you've played with or against from all the international trials on every other team, if not so the standards were sort of going up and I was being able to, able to rise to meet it, and all the signs were positive, basically, as you say. I kind of was getting into all the age group teams and Wasps were keen, and I was very fortunate in that they were redesigning the way they did their academy at the time. So prior to the year I joined, which I think is 2003, they'd had an under 19 team and an under 21 team, and they'd have about sort of 60 or so lads across those two age groups who would normally be doing some sort of university course and then coming and training in the evenings a couple of times a week, and they get a little bit of sort of boot money to get them through university. And what one of the first clubs, rugby-wise, I think, to turn around and say, actually, we're going to scrap that. We're going to have about, I think there are about 12, 15 lads across all those age groups who are going to train full-time with the first team. There was a second team league that was used to be starting, and it was thought that was where we'd get our playing experience. But day to day, we were going to be rubbing shoulders with the first team players, the internationals who were part of that. So, and the idea, I think, was just to putting most of their eggs in one basket, but in the hope that actually you could really develop those few players rather than just hoping for a few to kind of come out of the crowd when you've got a much bigger pool.
And I mean, I think that was evidence, kind of looking at some of the wins and the trophies that came for Wasps in the following years. You were fully part of that. I think it was two European titles that you'd won with the club.
I can't remember exactly. So I think I maybe only had the one, I can't remember if it was the one European, I think that whether I was with the club, I think for the first European, but I wasn't really playing at that point. I think that was my first year. So I played in a Premiership final and a Heineken Cup final, European Cup final. And there were lots of other trophies sort of in that time that I contributed to some. But I think the first European Cup, I think I was an academy player and I hadn't set foot on the pitch at that point. So I'd be remiss to claim I was responsible for that one.
For two wins, yeah. And I guess then 2007 came along. You made your full England debut against Scotland, I think.
Yeah.
And of course, got to play in the 2007 World Cup, which I think, you know, any rugby player or any rugby fans, you know, that would the dream playing in a World Cup for your country. I mean, that must have been truly significant in terms of, you know, what you'd set out from those days at Basingstoke and, you know, then moving on to the grammar school rugby. You know, what was that like having made that massive jump in a few years?
So yes, I suppose everything you say is right, but it was almost slightly double-edged sword. So the 2007 World Cup, I was the youngest player in the squad. I was really just starting out. There were a lot more sort of well-established and seasoned internationals there. And I played in the first two games, group games of the tournament. I played in the group game against America where we won but didn't play particularly well. And then the second group game where you'll be very happy, we got thumped by South Africa. And I was then, as I remember it, and this is something else you always realise when you read sort of rugby biographies and things and people looking back, you know, everyone sometimes have very different memories of what happened. But from what I can remember, I was told I was rested for the game against Samoa because they were such a physical team and I was one of the smaller members of our squad. And I think I picked up a little niggle in training during that week. And they said, oh, we'll rest you again for the game against Tonga. And then Lewis Moody went and played against Tonga and had an absolute blinder. Now, I felt that I'd been kind of one of the bright spots from the first two games, even though we hadn't gone well as a team. And I thought, well, I've still sort of owed a chance to come back into the squad. But they went with Lewis, and he played fantastically in the semi-final against Australia, and that kind of quarter-final against Australia, and that sort of cemented him in the team. So I had this strange thing of I was at a World Cup, and I've got a World Cup runners-up medal that came from the end of it, but my actual personal experience out there wasn't, you know, it didn't give me that sensation of what I wanted. I wanted to be playing in the final. At this point I was just completely hungry for success. I wanted to be the best in the world at everything, which probably wasn't sort of necessarily realistic certainly at the time, and perhaps not realistic ever. But I look back on that World Cup actually with really quite mixed feelings, because I didn't achieve what I wanted to do. And then it, when I look back in the scope of how my career then panned out afterwards, that was the only chance at that I got. And it didn't go the way I wanted. I also have moments where I look back and go, well, actually, what does it matter? I got to go to a World Cup. I've got the memories and was a part of that. And there are, you know, so few people who can say that. But equally there was a sense of, well, it's still not enough. I still wanted more.
And I guess that's tough because, you know, going into the 2007 World Cup, you probably would have been back looking back at the 2003 World Cup and thinking, you know, as a squad, we were in with a real chance, you know, and we could make this a 2007 win.
I think it was the England form certainly going into the tournament was nothing like it had been sort of prior to 2003. But there were quite a few guys who'd been part of 2003 who were still there. Although I think I seem to remember in 2003 there were cracks made about, you know, it was a pretty old team. And then a lot of those same players were still there 4 years later. We had Brian Ashton was the coach. He was a coach I adored and had worked with through various academy things sort of growing up. And Brian had a very he wanted to kind of empower players to think for themselves and, you know, to basically get the players to kind of buy into the way you want to play the game. And Brian's natural leaning was to be kind of open and attacking and not to have sort of really rigid structures. But a lot of those players, and again, this is my opinion, a lot of them would dispute this, a lot of those players had grown up with far more rigid structures and played in far more rigid structures in their clubs and actually were more comfortable with that. So there's some people that have sort of written about that World Cup that there was sort of a players' mutiny. And you know, they turn around and say, well, look, we're not going to play like we have done for the first two games. We're going to change things. We're going to do things much more rigidly. And then that led to England getting to the final. And whilst, you know, there's a degree of that's true, the players did stand up and say, look, we think we should do it like this. It certainly wasn't a mutiny. That was the sort of thing that Brian wanted players to do. They wanted them to take it. He wanted them to take ownership of what was going on. And it was when, after the first two games, the poor performance against America, the thumping by South Africa, sort of, you know, being written off left, right and centre. So there did become this slightly sort of siege mentality of like, right, OK, let's close ranks. Let's just, you know, hunker down and actually sort of dictate how we want to do things. And then all of a sudden that, again, the success sort of snowballed from there and it was just getting through each hurdle as it came.
And I guess that you've kind of, and you've used the word snowball again, and, you know, I'd like to draw on that because many people, regardless of the careers they're in, want to make big jumps, you know, so they'd start at some level in an organization and have aspirations to become the managing director or the CEO. And I think get disappointed when it doesn't happen as quickly as they want it to happen, or if it doesn't happen at all. And I guess looking at your, I don't want to say jump because we've used the term snowball, but club rugby to playing for your country in a World Cup, you know, it does look like a big jump. But would you describe it as it's more incremental improvements, smaller jumps? It's all about putting in that hard work along the way rather than just seeing it as going from 0 to 100.
Yeah, completely. There is always going to be that person who, and you know, stick within rugby, but there's always that guy who's just a freak, who is, you know, at 18 or 20 is already a fully developed man, or who has a skill set that is so far ahead of everybody else at that level that they can just compete on that top level from a ridiculously early age. And you know, that's, you know, that probably hides the fact that behind that there's still huge amounts of training and effort that's gone into getting them to that stage. But it seems, because no one has heard of them before they're 18, that they've come from nowhere. It kind of misses out everything leading up to that point. But for the majority of people, it is all about the graft away from the pitch that actually gets you to, you know, those performances and making those steps. And again, the change in the academy at Wasps, where before, if I'd been doing it 2 or 3 years beforehand, I'd have been training there, you know, twice a week with guys just, you know, within my own age, where I would have been one of, you know, probably one of the better players. To all of a sudden, I'm training every single day with the likes of Lawrence Dallaglio, Simon Shaw, Josh Lucy, guys who are World Cup winners, England international, British Lion players. And instead of being the big fish in the small pond, I could have been, you know, I'm the smallest fish trying to compete and survive in a world with these guys. And you know, there is an element of sink or swim, but there's no better environment to just to drag you up through exposure to all these other people. And it was that day-to-day exposure that just accelerated my progression. And I remember going to an England 21s camp, I think it was either in my second year at WAS or the tail end of my first, and myself and James Haskell went down. And we were so far ahead of the other guys in that squad in terms of physically, because we were training every single day, whereas they were probably, you know, sort of doing it on the side of uni courses and things like that. And, you know, I was never the most skillful player, but my skills were more reliable than lots of them because I was practicing it every day as opposed to, you know, fitting in around something else. So there's always so much more behind the scenes that goes into those big jumps. There are some people who make them, and I'm sure it's the same in sort of business, someone who just skyrockets quickly, but there is normally a foundation that underlies all of that, because otherwise it comes crumbling down fairly quickly and you get found out.
Yeah, I think you've said two significant things there. And the one is, you know, the graft that happens away from the pitch. And, you know, yes, you know, you've drawn that as an analogy to rugby, but, you know, certainly it's true. I think in any career, it's the additional work you put in, whether it's developing your skills, developing your knowledge, practicing your trade, you know, and I think that's a key takeaway for the listeners. And the other one, I said, you know, you said about exposing yourself to, I guess, that level of talent and skill that was out there, you know, and it certainly, as you said, you know, it pulls you along and helps you develop your skills. So again, and I think in any career that's important is, you know, find the people who are good at the thing you want to do and learn from them. You know, it's true in every profession.
Yeah, definitely. I'm trying to remember the book. Have you read Bounce?
I haven't, no.
I think it was in Bounce. But I remember reading in a book, there was this idea of what separates someone who's like an Olympic level athlete to someone who's a top level professional or, you know, top level below that. And they use the analogy of watching two figure skaters, and one figure skater was performing their routine flawlessly and it was all perfect, and the other was making mistakes. And he said, you know, if you had to bet on who was the better of the two from what had been described in practice, you'd have said, oh, it's the person who's flawless. And actually it was the person who was making all the mistakes was actually the higher level skater, and they were making mistakes because they were pushing beyond what was their comfort zone. The other person was just a very high level at what they did, but they were just practicing the things that they could do already and just getting that sorted. They didn't need to go any further. Whereas in order to get better, you have to try things, you have to make mistakes, you have to learn from that and move on. And I think, you know, I think that's something that universal sport, business, life, whatever, that if you can, you know, get your kind of your core skills, whatever they may be, you get them sort of down pat so you can always rely on it, but then you should always be trying to push it that little bit further and kind of get outside of your comfort zone. And then equally within that, when you're exposed to so many different people, I can remember one of my teammates saying there was a coach had sort of said, okay, well, you know, we want everybody to do this. And the details don't matter. It's very rugby specific, but it was not something that suited me for the physique and the style of player I was. And my teammate could see me really struggling with this. And he just sort of pulled me aside and said, look, take in everything that everybody has to offer, coaches, other guys, take it in, figure out what works for you, and then get rid of everything else. And just because someone said, oh, you know, okay, we need to do things like this, that doesn't mean it's necessarily going to work for you. And if you can find the thing that does work for you and build on that and play to your own strengths, that's going to serve you sort of much better in the long run than anything else.
I think that's some really good advice. And you talk about describing the figure skating story there, and people sometimes don't like pushing beyond their comfort zone because they're scared they're going to fail. But I guess, you know, the takeaway there is if you're comfortable with making mistakes and failing, you're going to learn from that, you know, rather than just staying in your comfort zone and only progressing to a certain point.
Mm. Yeah. And the word failing, it's, you know, yes, there's no getting away from the fact that, you know, if you try something and don't succeed at it, you fail. But there's not, that's not, you know, the end. It's not a finite thing of, right, well, you're done. Yes, there are occasions, World Cups and, you know, things like that, where, you know, if you fail to win the final, you've not won, and there may never be another opportunity at that. But it's, again, it's all the incremental things getting up to that point that if you haven't tried and failed and learned from, that you can then hopefully reapply when that situation comes up later. Should it ever come up, or, you know, if it comes up more often than not, there's nothing wrong with failing. It's just not trying is the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm just thinking of, and again, to use another rugby one, I think it was, it might have been Six Nations last year, Ireland versus France. And in the dying moment, Sexton took a drop kick from the 50-meter mark and obviously made it through the posts. But I'm betting that's not the first time he tried that.
Exactly. Looking, hammering those over in training the whole way through his career for that one moment where it becomes an option. And he will have missed countless drop kicks from all sorts of ranges. But, you know, he's put in the graft beforehand so that when he gets to that moment, he's given himself the best chance of pulling that off.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess then, you know, talking about progression, you know, there's obviously, and again, you know, drawing on your rugby career, the skills progression, maybe not changing positions so often, but I guess, you know, is there a point where you start thinking about progression in terms of leadership? You know, is there a point at which I'd really like to captain this team?
So I think it was, leadership's a funny one, because I think it's something that, but, you know, most people who are kind of competitive and driven, most people, I think, aspire not necessarily to, you know, to be the head honcho, to be up there and to influence the way the team that you're a part of works. I had been sort of captain and done leadership roles in age group teams and things when I'd younger, was younger. Part of that was just because I was one of the better players, and therefore it's kind of, you know, a typical sort of follow my example leadership, which is, you know, easy if you're good at something directly. But, not sounding like a complete muppet, but, you know, I was pretty thoughtful. I used to think, you know, I would think a lot about rugby, and I was like, right, I'm doing this, and I was committed and generally sort of reasonably professional and felt that I had something to offer from a leadership point of view. But then equally, I got exposed to someone like Lawrence Dallaglio, who sort of got leadership that sort of, you know, yes, he was one of the best players around, but he was also this massive sort of personality and sort of charisma and was sort of, you know, could really sort of bang a war drum. And that wasn't what I was. So actually, when I did end up sort of captaining Wasps with the club, I struggled with Lawrence's shadow, because he was such a huge figure at the club and all the success he'd achieved, but also just, you know, his presence around the place. But I felt that I almost had to try and sort of step into that, but actually that wasn't the sort of, you know, leadership that I could offer. And as it panned out, I started struggling with injuries and had to retire. And actually my sort of involvement in leadership with Wasps was sadly sort of limited, because I felt most comfortable leading when I was playing well. And I was out sort of saying, you know, if nothing else, I could say, look, I'm giving my all to this. People could buy into that in terms of following me, because they could see that, you know, I was giving my all for the cause. So if I was sort of sat on the sidelines injured, I suddenly felt that I'd lost the main thing that I could kind of contribute in terms of trying to influence other, you know, the others around me in terms of leadership. And that probably wasn't necessarily true, that I could have been perhaps more effective. And I did see other guys who did manage to do it, but it didn't work for me.
And I mean, it's interesting, you know, you talk about filling some large shoes, or some large boots in this case. you know, for people that are aspiring to a leadership position, you know, I think many of us recognize, you know, we can't be a Steve Jobs or an Elon Musk, you know, we're never going to be in that league, but that shouldn't detract from, you know, that aspiration. Are there any sort of tips that you'd give to people in that situation, you know, in terms of mindset and you know, carrying on?
Yeah, I think there's often a sense when people talk about leadership and leaders, everyone always goes to those big characters, you know, the people who are sort of seen at the top. Whereas actually, yes, there's no doubt that, you know, they will be a massive part of the success of whatever the enterprise is, but it's often the kind of, you know, for I guess lack of a better analogy, sort of from a military point of view, it's kind of the sergeants, you know, it's the little leaders on the ground who are kind of, you know, if they've got their own little team or you know, team within a team, or they've got their sort of little sort of project or their little sphere of influence, if you can just be like, right, okay, this is what I can do, this is how I can improve the little bit of the world around me that then fits into the bigger picture, that is, yes, it's not going to get the acclaim that at the top is going to get, but it's just as vital, because without people doing that sort of throughout whatever your job or whatever your experience is, without people laying that as a foundation, you know, the top has got nothing to build on.
That's an absolutely brilliant bit of advice. What I normally do is you'll see afterwards, I write up some of the show notes. So this is certainly one of those sound bites that'll appear in the show notes. That's a brilliant bit of insight. I guess then thinking about what we've been talking about, progression, we talked about golf as an example. Now, I guess golf is one of those sports where you could have a longer career in. Not to say that it's not a physical sport, but I guess, you know, everyone recognizes that rugby, you've got a limited time in which you can ply your trade as a professional. And having, you know, achieved national, international, European success, what was your thinking then beyond rugby? You know, what were the options you were considering?
Well, and I will meander here slightly, so forgive me, but it all started when I first got into the club. So when we first arrived, we had the RPA, the players' union, would sort of sit down and give a talk to the whole squad at the beginning of every year, and they say, "Look, on average, two of you in this room are going to retire this year because of injury." And you know, when you sort of look around, you know, there's only sort of 40 odd of you in the room. You know, it's a significant amount, but there's an 18-year-old who is convinced, "Well, I'm going to have the best rugby career ever. I'm going to, you know, captain everything and win every trophy, you know, that won't happen to me." And I guess because I'd had that kind of snowballing where everything had got better, it was just, you think, well, I'm just on this projection, then it's just going to sort of keep on going. So was kind of forewarned about all these things, and they'd say, "Look, you need to go and think about, you know, what you're going to do after rugby and preparing for that, even at 18, even if it doesn't come for another 15 years, you need to start to think." It fell on deaf ears initially. I think I did sign up to a university course, but it just didn't work. The time commitments of rugby, there wasn't the degree of flexibility for me to go and do an on-site study. Over then the course of the next few years, the question I got asked the most initially was, "Oh, so what would you be doing if you weren't here?" Because, you know, I was a nobody to rugby. So you'd turn up at the games, you'd be wearing all the kit, fans would come up and ask for your autograph and then say, "Oh, and what's your name?" And, you know, it was a good, you know, good reality check. But people will often say, "Oh, so if you weren't doing rugby, what would you be doing instead?" And I didn't know. And then over the course of the next few years, I got to meet so many different people, be that, you know, obviously coaches, reporters, fans, sponsors, you know, people who all did different things. And over time, you start to look at, well, okay, so what would I be doing if I wasn't here? And what does everybody else do? And what do I think of that? And I started to sort of say, well, okay, I don't think I'd be particularly interested in that. And I started to gravitate to the physios and the medics who were attached to the team. And, you know, I just found the process I just found it interesting, you know, what they were doing, and start to think, oh, okay, well, maybe actually, you know, I said I didn't want to be a doctor just because that's what my parents did. It wasn't because of anything else. Maybe it's something that I have thought was interesting. But initially I thought, well, I've missed the boat. It's too late because you need to go to university at 18 to do it. Then I heard about Jamie Roberts, who was a Welsh international, who was sort of coming to prominence and was doing medicine at the same time. So he had gone to university at 18, but had gone part-time to allow him to do rugby and study. And I thought, okay, well, you know, maybe it can be done, but Jamie's at Cardiff University and playing rugby for Cardiff. You know, the campus is almost next door. He's a Welsh international in Wales. You know, they'll be bending over backwards to help him out. I wasn't, probably going to go under the same support. And then I had two friends who were both working in graphic design. And then one turned around and decided he wanted to be an airline pilot, and the other turned around and decided he wanted to be a teacher. And just stopped what they were doing and went off and started pursuing that. And I thought, well, oh, well, why not? So my rugby career at this point was still going, but I started then sort of in my sort of mid-20s starting to look, okay, what would I need to do in order to get into medical school? And I went away and did an A-level at a college at evening classes because I didn't have a chemistry A-level, so I needed to sort of get that. And I started working towards it. And again, luck, I'd started that process just as I started picking up more and more serious injuries that would eventually end my career. So I had already kind of begun that process to transition into something else. But it was something I was forewarned at the very beginning. You know, it's always going to happen in rugby. Even if I had the career I'd wanted, I'd be in my sort of early to mid 30s at best. So I was always going to have to do something else. And I'd been warned about it from the start, but it took a while for me to figure out what that was going to be.
Yeah, no, it's certainly a journey, I think. And as you said at the start of the show, you know, where your fellow university students said to you, you know, this must be really difficult. You said, in contrast, I've had 10 years to really think about it. And, you know, the bits you told about your friends in terms of changing from graphic design to alternate careers, I guess, it, you know, just demonstrates that people do this stuff all the time. And you know, certainly you shouldn't rule anything else or rule anything out. I guess then the knee injury in 2012 was the decider, which you know, effectively ended your professional rugby career. And as you said, you'd had injuries before that. I think, you know, 2009, 2010, some problems with your shoulder. Did you at any stage in 2012 think, well, I can actually just sort of push through this?
So part of me, yes. And I think anyone who's got to any level in any sport has that sense of no, I can get through this. I can carry on, because you know very few people sort of really want to retire, particularly if they enjoy what they're doing. And I still had these sort of ambitions of no, I need to achieve that career that I felt I was kind of on the cusp of getting, and then it all fell away with the injuries. But I'd gone through the best part of 2 years of not playing with the shoulder injury and multiple surgeries. And then it was my first game back. It was a pre-season friendly in Argen. I came off the bench for the last 20 minutes. I was on the pitch for 5 minutes. I went to change direction. My studs got stuck in the turf and I popped my ACL and I just fell over. And that, having built the last 2 years almost feeling things like, right, I'm now back to the point where I can compete again and my shoulder's okay, I can do this, to feel like it's had the rug pulled out from underneath, there was part of me initially that was just like, I can't do this anymore. I've had enough. Because everything you're doing is striving to try and get to just to playing and the chance to achieve those things I wanted. And the, you know, I keep getting hurt and I keep not being able to get out onto the pitch. When the dust had settled, I kind of thought, no, okay, I can come back. It's just one more hurdle. You know, there's only so much bad luck that you can enjoy. I'd had so much good luck. I thought, you know, the bad luck can only last for so long. But then unfortunately, going through the rehab and everything else, my knee just wasn't right. And it was the knee surgeon who eventually said, look, my advice is you stop, you're done. And bizarrely at the time, that was a huge relief, because there was a part of me that would have just kept banging my head against a brick wall and making myself miserable, and would have just, through stubbornness, just refused to have given up. So to have somebody else that I could say, well, the decision's almost been made for me. They've said it. You know, that's it. I can walk away and think I haven't left anything out there. I've not tried it. I've not left something untried. And there's always going to be a suggestion of something else you can do to keep things going on. But all things considered, at that point, it was like, right, okay, I've got it, but I'm done, and I may need to move on to something else.
It's an important point you made there around, you know, almost effectively having the decision made for you, because, you know, many people that change jobs or start their own companies or start their own businesses is done through a decision almost outside of their control. You know, it could be a redundancy. It could be, you know, all the fallout we're seeing now from the pandemic. So that's a really important point. And I think still though, you know, it's especially for you, it would have been a huge disappointment. What sort of, you know, from a mindset point of view, was there any approach that you took that you could recommend to people that are in that situation to deal with kind of negative thoughts or, you know, having made such a big shift?
Yeah, it's difficult because I think initially there was a sense of relief, as in, you know, I had been miserable. But then that very quickly got replaced by the kind of the finality of it. And the fact this thing that, you know, I had defined myself as a professional rugby player. It was more than just my job. It was who I was. And that instantly ceased to exist. So there was very much a sense of, well, you know, what am I? Who am I now? And I got sort of quite lost. Now, I suppose it's important to say I had, in the background, been going through the application process to medical school in the hope that I'd have been able to find some way to do both. But I had a place to start at university 6 months later. So that was always, you know, I had something in the future that I could say, right, I can move towards that. But I did get very down about it all and really struggled and had really dark thoughts. Because, you know, I just had no identity. I had no purpose. And again, there wasn't one thing that pulled me out of that. It was the support of friends and family. There was an outpouring of support from people in rugby. And just, you know, it's always helpful when people write nice things about you, which is obviously easy to do once you know, they know you're not coming coming back. So that was, you know, sort of, you know, padded my ego in the wake of everything that happened, that people sort of would say, oh, you know, he was good and could have been great and all these things. So that helped, but actually just friends and family kind of just sort of keeping me going, but having to kind of adjust and say, yeah, my goal had been rugby and that was it. And when that had gone, having to try and find just something else that I could say, okay, that's where I'm going. It doesn't even need to be something really specific. For me, it was just, I need to get to starting and getting on the course. And once I'm there, then I can figure things out from there. But just having some idea of where I was going, even if it wasn't, you know, a concrete plan, it was just having some sense of purpose.
And I guess, I mean, that's an important thing. You know, you said you tied your identity to being a professional rugby player. And I think, you know, for many people, that's difficult. They tie their identity to the job they do. And when that job ceases to exist, you know, they end up in a bad place. So I think, as you've said, you know, support of friends, family, colleagues, these things are all important. And also looking forward. And, you know, as you said, you'd already put the bits in place in terms of doing your chemistry A-levels, you know, I think signing up for university. So, you know, you'd say, well, I was lucky. I've got these things on the go already. But again, you know, they were conscious decisions that you made.
Yeah, I think there is an element of, you know, you've always got to have, yeah, I suppose it's the same thing about, you know, if you're trying to improve within your business, that we're going back to the figure skater, trying to push forward to the next thing. I suppose even if that thing's going really well, you know, have you got stuff in the background that's just going to push you forward, even if it's not directly related to what you're doing at the time? I was fortunate. It wasn't like I was made redundant from something that I didn't see coming. Okay, I wasn't anticipating my career ending the way it did, but it was always going to end. And I was always going to have to do something else. So I was already preparing for that. But it was only when I actually started preparing for it did I realize how much, some people, they kind of say, oh, wow, medicine, rugby, they're, you know, two completely different things. And yes, but actually the things that make you successful at something are things that you can apply in so many different ways. And there was a chap called Ben from the Rugby Players Union who sat down and kind of went through with me when I was having to write, for the first time in my life, I had to write a CV. And I thought, well, what am I going to put on it? I was just going to say, you know, can catch rugby ball, you know, can run into but that was essentially the limit of my skill set. And some people would debate whether I could even do the catching bit. But they said, well, no, you've performed in an elite environment at the very top of that profession, you know, when loads of other people do it. You're involved in leadership teams and making decisions. And it was actually a lot more about all the things that were, again, it's not the stuff on the pitch that was useful. It was all the stuff that went into being a successful rugby player, time management, which was not a strong point of mine initially. And again, I learned some lessons fairly sharply in the company of Lawrence Dallaglio about being punctual. But all of these things that make you a professional, whatever, you can apply to different things. And it was only when I sort of sat down and started going through that process, I realized, okay, I can say I could probably do that, or I've got experience in this, even if it might seem strange tying it to rugby.
Well, you know, I think if there's one thing I can take away from our talk, it's that statement you made about the things that have made you a success, you can apply to other areas of, I suppose, your life and profession. And, you know, ultimately, again, as I said at the start, this is what the podcast is really about. And I guess going in, you've given time management as an example. You know, reskilling as a doctor is not a quick journey. So, you know, what are the other sorts of things that you took with you, you know, either that you learned on or off the pitch, that have helped you through this journey now to become a doctor?
So I think that the biggest thing, and I think a lot of people will sort of say, oh, you have to be really clever to be a doctor. And I don't think you do. You have to be prepared to work hard to be a doctor. And, you know, it's the same for success in everything. But Sean Edwards, who's the best rugby coach I ever had the pleasure to work with, he had this phrase, if you want to be successful, you have to be prepared to suffer. And, you know, that might sound melodramatic, but, you know, when you're going through training sessions where guys are vomiting because of the level of kind of physical exertion, and, you know, and you think, well, why am I doing this? And it's like, well, it's so that we can have a guy land a drop goal from 50 meters in the last minute of the game to win it. You know, you've got to suffer for those things in advance. And I think medicine is something similar. There's just such a massive knowledge base that's needed. You don't necessarily need to be clever to take that on board. You just need to be able to just keep working through it and suffer through the fact that lots of it can be really boring. Lots of it is amazing and fascinating, but, you know, it's just keeping going through all of those things. I think trying to take an attitude of, what can I take away from this situation? You know, again, in your rugby training sessions, it would be easy to be out there all day and flog yourself until you can barely walk. But what's the point of it? What are you trying to achieve? And I think the same thing, you know, you get into sort of medical school and sort of you sit there in a lecture theatre for 2 years and then you're thrown out onto the wards. And often it's quite sort of, you know, it's very easy to just turn up and be a spectator and just see these sort of things going on and just hope that you're going to kind of learn from osmosis. But if I could go in each day and be like, right, okay, well, I am going to get X, Y, Z out of today. I am going to try and get a chance to take blood from a patient, or I am going to, you know, take a history from a patient I don't know anything about. Just having something specific that you can say, right, that's my goal of what I'm trying to get out of today. And I think those things certainly helped. There are aspects as well that, you know, I recognize that I struggle with. So one of the great things about the rugby is you had so many people around you who were all geared to just promoting your performance. You know, the fitness trainers, the physios, nutritionists, coaches, everyone is all, essentially everything is directed at you. So there is a lot of things that you're kind of spoon-fed a bit. And I definitely struggle even now with the fact that I have to take much more responsibility for not so much my learning, because, you know, I'm trying to say, like, what can I get out of this even on the day-to-day job? But I now have to document that I've done that. So essentially, I struggle with the paperwork because I've never had to do paperwork before in my life. But it's kind of, even that is recognizing, okay, where are the areas where I struggle and what can I do that are going to kind of, you know, what can I do to mitigate my own weaknesses? I think those are some of the things I think rugby is kind of, yes, you know, for me, it was rugby that crystallized those in my mind. But, you know, for anybody else, it could be whatever they've been through beforehand. But recognizing what it is that makes you good at something and how can you apply that to, you know, whatever situation you find yourself in.
I think those are some great, great takeaways. And I've just gotten so much from this talk. I got loads of notes. I'm really excited to be sharing all of these takeaways with the listeners. I guess a few shorter questions before we end as we reach the end of the episode. I think so many people will never have the opportunity of making their passion a career. You know, what would you say? How do you incorporate that passion, you know, within your life? So, an example, you know, how is rugby still a part of your life?
Rugby isn't a massive part of my life now, partly because of the lack of time. There's supposed to be quicker answers. I didn't want to be hanging on to rugby by my fingernails, clinging on to past glories. I still enjoy watching it, much more so now that most of my peers have retired, so I don't feel like I'm missing out anymore. But I did a bit of refereeing. I did a bit of, and still do occasionally, disciplinary panels. So I'd have involvement with rugby, but in a very, very different context to kind of playing or training. But it's about having, you know, within medicine, it's about having other things you can do that can take you out of that space that is your job. So now I'm sort of trying to revisit learning the guitar and just having other things that can take me away from work. When work is rubbish, I can just go, okay, I'm going to not think about it and do something else.
Yeah, no, that's great. I think, you know, and the reason I asked it is because, talking again about rugby, it might not be incorporating rugby as a player, but as you said, you'd been involved in other aspects of the game. And certainly, you know, if I aspire to be a professional musician, which there's no chance of that ever happening, like you do, you can learn the guitar and, you know, it can just be an outlet rather than a profession. So I think that's some great advice.
Yeah. And I do still hope that, as you know, I sort of progress through my training and there's not quite the same time commitment sort of to just the training process, that I maybe actually go back and start doing some rugby refereeing again. But it's just a question of making sure I've got the opportunity and all the other things that, you know, family and things like that in life don't lose out. Because that's one thing that it's really easy, and rugby did at times become all consuming. it has left me with a sense of I've got to have other aspects to my life rather than just this one thing. Even if rugby hadn't fallen over, going off and doing study made me a better rugby player when I actually initially at the time I thought it was going to detract from it. And I think that's, again, something I carried over.
Yeah, that's great advice. Have other aspects to your life rather than just a single thing. Okay, my final question is, you mentioned a book already called Bounce. I'll find that book and pop it up on the show notes. But are there any other reads that you'd recommend, any good reads to the listeners?
I'm trying to remember Bounce, certainly, because I think I'm trying to remember if the tagline was sort of the myth of talent and the power of practice. I think that was Bounce. On a medical leaning, there's a guy called Atul Gawande who has written a number of books. He's an American surgeon who I think also has a column in the New York Times. He's written a number of books. There's Complications, and I think that's about, you know, how can you get better at something. The Checklist Manifesto, again, sort of having processes to make risky things as safe as possible, and how can checklists improve the way we do things? But I know when I say checklists, a lot of people will just think, oh Christ, you know, tick box exercises. But he puts it on the fact that a good checklist is not a tick box exercise. It's an aid to the skills people should have, and goes into how you go about making something like that. And that was really good. And then he's got another book called Being Mortal, which is him sort of talk about all of his experience as a surgeon and having tried to essentially to save lives and to correct all these sort of problems, but actually facing up that ultimately we're all going to die, and what do we want our deaths to look like? And it's a very different shift from the focus of his previous books, but he writes in a way that sort of, you know, it's reasonably sort of matter in fact, but also very engaging. And he'll tell it, you know, he sort of tells a good story to back up his point. So anything by Atul Gawande, I'd recommend.
Okay, brilliant. And I'll look up those three titles and put them in the show notes too, so people can just link through to them. Tom, that's been brilliant. Thank you so much for your time, especially as it's your time off, as we said earlier. I really do appreciate you sharing your story, your challenges and your insights. And also want to say thank you for the work that you do as part of the NHS. It does make a huge difference. So, thanks for both of those. I've really enjoyed our talk, and I'm so glad you've come on the show.
No, thank you for having me.
Wow, what a great story. And thank you again, Tom Rees, for making the time available to join us on the show. I really enjoyed it, and I'm sure the listeners did too. Thank you so much for sharing your insights as well. There were so many gems that came out as we went through the show. As usual, I'd like to end the show with just highlighting a few of those from having listened to it again. And no doubt, when I listen to it another time, I'll find even more. These are all available as show notes, as I said, but I just want to touch on a few of them. And one of the things that we spoke about early on in the show was luck and how luck plays a part in success. But ultimately, it's working hard that brings that luck. We said it's not like winning the lottery where the only effort you have to put in is buying a ticket. This is slightly different. That goes hand in hand with success not being an overnight thing. And the term that Tom used a number of times was snowballing. And that's really about small achievements, small wins and small skills, building small skills, how those all snowball and become bigger and ultimately bring more success. Tom said something very important in terms of his parents encouraging him, saying, you know, they didn't make him do anything, but they encouraged him to try everything. And that's really important, you know, and this could be a parent, it could be a coach, you know, a sports coach, a personal coach, a life coach, it could be a careers counselor, it could be a teacher or a mentor. This is just really something important to note, I think. Take ownership of what's going on in your job or career. That was a clear message as well that came out and something that Tom talked about. He also talked about it's the hard work away from the pitch that leads to success. And in this case, the pitch was a rugby pitch. But in our lives, in any of our lives, it could be any facet of our lives. You know, it could be our family. It could be our job. It's all the work that goes in behind the scenes that makes you a success, whether it's self-improvement, building relationships, building skills, all of these sorts of things. On the theme of building skills, Tom said about exposing yourself to those who are more skilled or experienced and learning from them. You know, taking in what's been made available, finding what works for you and using that. You know, obviously what works for one person might not work for everyone else, but it's about exposing yourself to those experiences and those skills and taking away from them. There was a great analogy with the ice skating, or the ice skating was used as a great analogy, or figure skating, around making mistakes, being comfortable making mistakes to push you beyond your limits, or to kind of help you understand, you know, that your limits aren't where you think they are. Also, Tom said about, you know, you don't need to be at the top of everything, you know, the best in the world. What you do need to do is you need to improve just a little bit of the world around you. And I think that's in cognizance. You know, we spoke about Elon Musk and Steve Jobs and you know, those titans of industry and that sort of thing. And thinking, you know, not everyone can be like that. But what you can do is you can improve a little bit of the world around you. And, you know, that'll make your impact truly felt. Don't define yourself by your job. And I think, you know, this interview was testament to that. As Tom had said, you know, he defined himself as a rugby player, and you know, when that career ended, you know, where to next? So it's important, I think, for all of us not to define ourselves by our jobs, because you know, we are more than we do as a job. You know, relying on friends, family, and colleagues during tough times, I think, you know, especially now, but at some stage in our lives, we're all going to go through tough times, and you know, having a support structure there is important. Understandably, some people don't, but there are organizations as well that are out there. You know, we've spoken about it in a number of our episodes that were focused on resilience and mental health. So please, you know, if you do feel you are at that point, there are organizations out there that can help. Understand things that have made you successful to the point at where you are, and then apply those to other areas. And you know, that's the whole thing about transferable skills. And while we focus so much on those transferable skills, or highlighting or finding those in this podcast, so you know, those do the work to find out what those skills are and apply them to other areas of your life. And yeah, those are the sort of key takeaways. There were so many more, you know, certainly around what Tom said, his learnings were in the professional game of rugby and how he took those forward into his medical career. So I hope you enjoyed the show. Please leave comments. Please remember to get in touch with any comments. And I look forward to talking to you on the next show. Thank you, and keep safe.